Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The third most powerful hurricane on record to hit the U.S. mainland has caused widespread damage in several southern states. It also led to at least two deaths. Hurricane Michael struck land in northern Florida Wednesday as a Category 4 hurricane, with winds up to 250 kilometers per hour. On Thursday, Michael weakened to a tropical storm, with winds of about 80 kilometers per hour as it kept moving northeast. Weather officials believe the storm will pass over North and South Carolina before heading out to the Atlantic Ocean in coming days. One man was killed when a tree fell onto his house outside Tallahassee, Florida. In southwest Georgia, an 11-year-old girl died after debris from the storm hit her home. More than 700,000 homes and businesses were left without power in Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. Thousands spent the night in shelters after fleeing their homes to escape the storm. Television footage showed flooding and destruction in the small Florida town of Mexico Beach, where the storm first made landfall. Many homes were shown covered with floodwaters up to their roofs. Wood and metal from destroyed buildings covered streets and moved through flooded neighborhoods. A number of buildings were destroyed or left without roofs in nearby Panama City, Florida. Empty streets were covered with storm debris, fallen trees, and downed power lines, the Associated Press reported. The storm left hundreds of cars with broken windows, the AP said. Many of the cars had been moved by the wind. Brock Long leads the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. He said Michael was the most intense hurricane to strike that part of Florida since record-keeping began in 1851. Overall, Michael was the third strongest storm on record to strike the U.S. mainland. Only Hurricane Camille on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in 1969 and the unnamed Labor Day hurricane of 1935 in Florida were more intense. U.S. President Donald Trump spoke about the storm on Wednesday night. He offered his thoughts and prayers to those in its path. He said he would be visiting Florida soon. Rick Scott is the governor of Florida. He said about 3,500 Florida National Guard troops had been activated. The U.S. Defense Department sent an additional 2,200 military troops to the area, along with helicopters and water rescue vehicles. Scott promised his government would do everything it can to help communities suffering effects from the storm. I'm Brian Lynn.
South Korea's Jeju Island welcomed naval forces from over 10 countries at the start of a 5-day international naval event. Yet painful memories of World War II appeared this week when Japan chose to stay away from the yearly exercise. Japan is less than 1,000 kilometers away from Jeju Island. Japan said it would miss the event after South Korea asked Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force not to fly its naval ensign, the 16-ray Kyokujitsuki, or Rising Sun, flag. South Korea and other Asian countries strongly link the Rising Sun flag with Japan's aggression during the 20th century. Some even go as far as to link the flag to war crimes and consider it a lasting symbol of World War II. South Korea's Navy had asked all nations taking part in the exercise to fly their national flags as well as the South Korean flag on their ships. Some observers saw that request as a way to prevent Japanese ships from flying the Rising Sun flag. Japanese officials told the Associated Press that it is Japanese law for the country's naval ships to fly that flag. The officials added that only private ships fly the national flag, known as Hinomaru. This is done to differentiate between commercial and naval ships. Japanese Chief of Staff Katsutoshi Kawano said the flag was an issue of pride for the Maritime Self-Defense Force sailors. He regretted the dispute with South Korea over its use. Japan rejects the idea that the naval ensign is a sign of war. South Korean Prime Minister Lee Nak-yoon noted his nation's opposition toward the flag earlier this month. He said Japan must carefully consider the effect that the Rising Sun flag has on the Korean people, who remember the pain of colonial rule. The hostility toward the naval ensign is not limited to political issues. It also appears in South Korean popular culture. In 2016, Korean singer Tiffany was removed from a television show because she used a Rising Sun flag emoji on Instagram. She posted the picture on August 15th to celebrate Liberation Day, the holiday marking Japan's World War II surrender. Her use of the emoji immediately angered people. The television station announced Tiffany's removal from the show 3 days later. It is not just the flag itself that creates strong reactions. In some cases, a similar-looking design does too. Earlier this year, Nike canceled the release of footwear covered with the design. In addition, the Height Brewery Company discontinued similar markings on its beer products, even though the colors of its design were purple and blue.
Imagine that you are at a restaurant for breakfast. You want something to drink, but you are not sure what. When the server walks over to your table, he says,
"Let me help. Do you prefer coffee or tea?"
You answer,
"I prefer tea to coffee."
You just told the server about a general preference. The server then makes a few suggestions about the teas available. When we are given choices, There are special phrases we use to say which thing we like more than another. We call these choices preferences. In our program today, we will show you how to use general and specific preferences. We have different phrases for each. To begin, let's look at general preferences. A general preference is something you like more as a whole. It is not tied to a specific event or time. It is simply a fact about your likes. For example, you probably like one style of music more than another style, and you like one kind of food more than another food. Phrases we usually use for general preferences are prefer and like better. They have the same meaning. Let's talk about the word prefer and hear the coffee and tea example again.
Do you prefer coffee or tea?
Notice that the word or is used in the question form. In the answer, we use the preposition to or over.
I prefer tea to coffee. I prefer tea over coffee.
As you might know, in English, when we answer a question, we do not usually answer with full wording. If asked about a preference, you can simply name the preference like this.
I prefer tea.
Here is another example of a question and answer.
Do you prefer living in the city or the suburbs?
I prefer living in the city.
In American English, prefer is a little more formal, but still common enough to use in everyday speech. But Americans are more likely to use the phrase like better when talking with others. We use the word than after this phrase. Here is how we do that in a question and answer.
Do you like tea or coffee better?
I like tea better than coffee.
Again, when answering, we usually only name the preference.
I like tea better.
Here is another example of a question and answer.
Do you like living in the city or the suburbs better?
I like living in the city better.
Notice that in question form, the word better comes at the end of the question. Now let's turn to specific preferences. A specific preference is something you like or want more at a given point in time, either right now or in the future. We use the expressions would prefer and would rather to talk about such things. These phrases have the same meaning. Let's look at the phrase would rather. It is much more common in American spoken English than would prefer. For both phrases, we almost always use the short form of the word would with a personal pronoun. We call the shortened form a contraction. For example, the contraction of I would is I'd. When would is contracted, it looks and sounds just like the letter D. Listen to the normal form and the contraction of would rather. With would rather, we use the word than in the response.
Would you rather go out or stay home?
I would rather go out than stay home. I'd rather go out than stay home.
Again, we usually only name the preference in responses.
I'd rather go out.
And if there is only one main verb after would rather, we do not say it two times. Here is an example.
Would they rather study French or English?
And the answer.
They'd rather study English.
Notice that the verbs go, stay, and study are in simple form, the basic form without to before it or any letters at the end. After would rather, we always use the simple form of verbs. Just like would rather, we can use would prefer to talk about specific preferences. But to Americans, would prefer sounds more formal, and we do not use it often in speaking. Here is an example of a question and answer.
Would you prefer to go out or stay home?
I'd prefer to go out.
Note that when Americans do use would prefer, we usually only name the preference, as in the example. However, when the answer mentions both choices, Americans usually say it this way.
I'd prefer to go out than stay home.
It may take time for you to become comfortable with the sounds of the contraction of would with personal pronouns. It helps to pay attention to what comes after the d sound. If you hear the word rather or prefer afterward, then you know someone is telling you about a preference. And I could say a lot more on this subject, but I'd rather end it here. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Andrew Johnson. Johnson was vice president under Abraham Lincoln and became president in 1865 after Lincoln was killed. His name sounds like that of an earlier president, Andrew Jackson, and also like a later president, Lyndon Johnson. But Andrew Johnson served in the years just after the Civil War. You can remember Johnson this way. He was the first U.S. president to be impeached. Andrew Johnson grew up in a poor family in the southern state of North Carolina. As a child, Johnson had little formal education. Instead, he trained to be a tailor. When he was a young man, Johnson moved to Tennessee, another southern state. He opened a tailoring business where he made, repaired, and sold clothing. When he was 18 years old, he married. His wife, Eliza McCardle, was only 16. They went on to have 5 children together. Eliza McCardle Johnson did not come from a wealthy family either, but she was better educated than her husband, and she helped him develop his reading and writing skills. She also supported his gift for public speaking. Johnson's speeches were especially popular with workers in their community. They liked his criticism of the state's wealthy planters. The workers also liked his politics. At the time, Johnson supported measures that permitted slavery to expand across the country. He was clear in his speeches that he did not support equality between whites and African Americans, whether enslaved or free. In time, Johnson held many political offices: mayor, Tennessee's governor, state legislator, and member of the U.S. House of Representatives. When the Civil War began, he was a member of the U.S. Senate. Although he was a Southerner, he did not believe the Southern states had a right to withdraw from the Union. When the other Southern senators resigned from the U.S. Congress, Johnson stayed. As a result, most Southerners considered him a traitor, but most Northerners considered him a hero. By 1864, the American Civil War was 3 years old. The conflict was becoming increasingly fierce and bloody. That year, the states that remained in the Union held their presidential election. The president, Abraham Lincoln, wanted to win re-election and continue directing the Union's war effort. But he was not sure that voters in the opposition Democratic Party would support him. So he turned to Andrew Johnson to be his choice for vice president. Johnson was a pro-slavery Democrat. Lincoln was an anti-slavery Republican. In the U.S. tradition, presidential candidates do not usually choose someone from a different party to serve as vice president. But in this case, Lincoln's Republicans did. They called the Lincoln-Johnson partnership the National Union Party. Political leaders hoped Johnson would appeal to Democrats who supported the war effort, to workers, and to small farmers. The plan, along with several military successes for the Union, helped carry the National Union Party to victory. The swearing-in ceremony the following March, however, suggested some of the difficulties ahead. Johnson was sick. To feel better, he had a lot of alcoholic drinks the night before the ceremony. The next morning, he drank some more. When Johnson stood to give his speech, he appeared unsteady. He talked about his poor family and his simple beginnings. Then he spoke angrily about wealthy Southern planters who had withdrawn from the Union. He became increasingly confused. Other people in the crowd wrote later that they felt embarrassed by Johnson's behavior, and some Republicans began calling already for his resignation, or even impeachment. Those critics could not have predicted that in a few weeks, Johnson would be the president. A few very important events happened in the weeks after Lincoln and Johnson were sworn in. In April, Lincoln was shot and killed. Johnson took office as the new president. The following month, the Civil War officially ended. The Confederate States of America was no more. And that December, a majority of states approved the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That amendment ended slavery across the country. President Johnson, therefore, guided the process of reuniting the North and South and supervised the transition of many African Americans from slavery to freedom. That period in U.S. history is called Reconstruction. Members of Congress from the northern states had been thinking for a long time about how to carry out Reconstruction. The most extreme lawmakers, the radical Republicans, wanted to punish former Confederate officials and extend political and civil rights to African Americans. Johnson had different ideas. In the first months of his presidency, before Congress had met, Johnson pardoned many former Confederate officials. He also let Southerners rebuild their state governments as they wished. Those governments quickly passed laws called Black Codes. Black Codes restricted the freedom and rights of African Americans. They permitted white landowners to control African Americans' labor, much as they had when the workers were slaves. The laws were enforced by all-white police and militia. Radical Republicans in Congress, as well as African Americans, objected strongly to the Black Codes. When Congress finally did meet, Republican lawmakers voted for a measure to help and protect formerly enslaved people. But Johnson vetoed the measure. He said the bill would give the federal government too much power. Johnson's veto was one move in a political war between the president and many Republicans. In time, lawmakers got the upper hand. The Republican Congress soon took control of Reconstruction. Against Johnson's wishes, they succeeded in passing several major pieces of legislation. One was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. It recognized that everyone born in the United States, including African Americans, although not Native Americans, was a citizen. Another was the extension of the Freedmen's Bureau Act, the measure that Johnson had earlier vetoed. For 2 more years, the federal government was authorized to help people displaced by the Civil War. Finally, lawmakers passed a measure barring the president from dismissing any top officials without the approval of Congress. President Johnson ignored the measure. When he believed the Secretary of War did not treat him respectfully, the president ordered that man's dismissal. In answer, members of the U.S. House of Representatives voted to impeach Johnson. In other words, they charged him with a crime. It was the first time in U.S. history that a president has been impeached. But impeached does not always mean removed from office. The case moves to the Senate. There, senators act as a jury. They decide whether the president is guilty. 2/3 of the Senate must agree to convict the president. In the case of Andrew Johnson, 54 senators considered his case. For him to be removed from office, 20 would need to find him guilty. But only 19 did. His position was saved by a single vote. Although Johnson survived impeachment, he was not nominated as a candidate for president in the next election. Instead, he returned to his home in Tennessee, then competed for a seat back in Congress. On the third try, he succeeded. Johnson is the first and only, so far, former president to serve as a senator. He did not stay in the position long, however. A few months after returning to Congress, Johnson died suddenly after suffering a stroke. He was 66 years old. Today, historians have mixed feelings about his presidency. Johnson's supporters approve of his limits on the federal government and belief in a firm separation of powers among Congress, the president, and Supreme Court. But most historians believe Johnson's Reconstruction policies were extremely damaging. They did not help reunite the North and South, and they extended the suffering of African Americans and the country's history of racial oppression.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.